Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Thousands of people took to the streets in this country in all 50 states to protest the separation of migrant families and President Trump's zero-tolerance policy at the border. Almost 2 weeks ago, President Trump signed an executive order calling for an end to his own administration's policy on family separation. But it remains unclear how the administration actually plans to reunite the 2,000-plus children who had been separated from their families. Last week, a federal judge demanded that children be reunited with their families within 30 days. Joining us now is Debbie Nathan, a freelance reporter covering the border for The Intercept, and Dara Lind, a senior reporter with Vox covering immigration. Welcome to you both.
Hi, thank you.
Great to be on.
So, Debbie, let's start with you. You live in Brownsville, Texas, which is right on the border with Mexico. What are you seeing in terms of your reporting at the border?
Well, this area, this region is ground zero for zero tolerance and the separation of parents and kids. What I'm seeing still is a tremendous amount of confusion, and I've been interviewing parents in detention who, I mean, haven't even heard of the injunction or even the executive order. Parents who still haven't spoken with their children and who haven't become aware, haven't been told anything about how these reunifications might take place. And, you know, the other thing that I've seen is, especially during the demonstrations over the last, you know, really like 10 days, people coming out, and in some cases just, you get the feeling from some of the demonstrators that they're, particularly Latinos in this community, that they're really at the end of their rope emotionally and all other ways.
So I want to go back a second to the injunction, because this was something that happened just a couple days ago, and I'm not sure how much our listeners really understand what happened. So this was a federal judge that ruled that children needed to be reunited. Is there any movement on that front, or is it just pure confusion?
I think it's maybe confused movement. I mean, you know, I've been told, for example, that at the detention center that's closest to me in Brownsville, which is called Port Isabel, that there seem to be a lot of people, a lot of officials now coming into that facility. And that is supposed to be the staging area where people will be reunited. And I believe that it has the most parents detained. So, I mean, you know, so you hear about people going into that facility, but then when I talk to parents who are actually there, they haven't heard anything. There hasn't been any contact. And then lawyers I've spoken with that are working with people in other facilities say that it's still extremely hard to impossible for them to even locate the children on behalf of the parents.
The Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is responsible for keeping, you know, track of the children while they're in custody separated from their parents, testified that over the last week they've reunited a whole seven of the over 2,000 children who are still separated, which indicates that the pace on this is not quite at pace to get to reunifying all 2,000 within 30 days.
Now, what about the 500, though? Weren't there 500, and you're saying so? So tell us where that discrepancy comes in.
Right. So before the court order came down, but after President Trump signed the executive order that kind of opened the door for them to prosecute parents without separating families, Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection said that they had returned 500 children in their custody to their parents. Now, what that means is that the law requires that within 72 hours, kids who are without their parents be sent to ORR, under Health and Human Services. So that means that there were 500 kids who, between, you know, in the 72 hours before last Friday evening, so probably the day before Trump signed the executive order, had been separated from their parents and could then be easily reunited with their parents without having to go back to the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which has its own process that starts when a child is transferred to custody there.
Yeah, these families were like in what the immigrants call the perrera, which is everybody's seen the pictures of the kennels or the fences, like people on one side of a fence and then the kids on another side of the fence and the men in one area, the women in another. And in a lot of cases, people could see each other. Parents could see children and vice versa. So it was no big deal because they were all literally in the same facility to just put them back together again. But, you know, those were that window that Dara's talking about. You know, it doesn't really mean anything because the real problem is when the parents were sent to ICE, which sent them to the detention facilities, and the children were sent to Office of Refugee Resettlement Facilities, you have two different agencies that don't seem to be communicating with each other.
Yeah, it's worth noting that for everything Debbie is saying about the lack of coordination, the government was telling the federal judge in this case that they, and telling the public, that they knew where all the children were, they knew where all the parents were, they could reunite them whenever they wanted, and they were choosing to allow them to be reunited when the parent got a final order of deportation. They could have the child come back with them to their home country. That, I think, is part of what led the judge to believe that it was possible to order them to reunite families within 30 days. And it's not clear whether the government overpromised on this or whether they're just not going as quickly as you would assume they could if they really did know where everyone was.
So this sounds to me like a mess, quite frankly. And I'm wondering if either of you can help us understand how is the federal government promising to, or at least attempting after this ruling, to reunite families, and how are they keeping track of these children?
I think that as far as keeping track of children are concerned, the thing you have to remember about this is there are several different agencies involved here. And so each agency may very well be taking care of, you know, people in its custody. The Office of Refugee Resettlement may very well know where children are, whether they're in temporary holding facilities, whether they've been placed with relatives as sponsors or placed in some cases with temporary foster care, and not necessarily have the wherewithal to communicate that with the Department of Homeland Security, because this agency is set up to deal with kids who come into the U.S. without their parents. It's not set up to simultaneously be taking care of children and to figure out which detention center along the border their parents are being held in. That's not a function they've served until really this spring.
You know, and just down here, I'll tell you a couple of experiences that I've had as reporting. I was in court a few days ago, and there were 18 people in a mass trial, and four of the people were Central Americans. And when the judge, who has taken to asking people, have any of you been separated from your children? One man said yes. He was from El Salvador. And the judge said to the prosecutor, where is the child? And the prosecutor said, I don't know, judge, but I can find out momentarily. And sure enough, a few minutes later, another prosecutor entered with a folder, and the one who was doing the trial said, oh, you know, this child is in, and actually it turned out to be the place where Senator Markley had been. So, you know, it took minutes to locate this child. But on the other hand, I've also spoken with, as I said, lawyers who have been unsuccessful. You know, these are lawyers, pro bono lawyers who've come in and they've got individual clients that they're working with and they've been unable to locate the kids. And I've also heard from lawyers that they've heard of ORR and DHS, like, asking nonprofits, where is this particular child? So, you know, it's just hard to figure out what they know and what they don't know.
Adding to that is also the fact that there are children scattered all across the United States. We've seen one of our local channels here in New York reported that New York State, in fact, is one of the states that has received some of the largest numbers of kids. The question I have is, how is it that these kids are being separated into these states? What is the state's responsibility once a child crosses into New York or Texas or anywhere that they might be? And what can the states do to, if anything, to help move this reunification process along?
You know, it's very weird for me to see this. And, you know, Debbie, I'm sure that you have a little bit of deja vu as well, because the last time that anyone was really paying attention to these, you know, shelters where kids are being held was in 2014, when the problem was, you know, lots of children coming across without family members into the U.S. and when the local pressure was from communities that didn't want unauthorized immigrants in their communities. So to see the same kind of localized political backlash for very different reasons is odd and does kind of go some way to explaining why the government is trying to be a little bit secretive about this. They don't really want to give information out about where minors are being held for, you know, reasons of privacy, for reasons of wanting to protect kids. But it's important to remember that, again, they weren't set up to keep kids near their parents because they weren't set up for kids who were in the same country as their parents. So in many cases, the facilities that are best equipped to care for kids that don't look like, you know, jails that have been stood up in 2 weeks' time are places in New York and, you know, Massachusetts and other states. But that does pose a real problem. If and when parents are released from immigration detention, they have to try to figure out what time zone their child is in. They have to figure out what hours are, you know, it's going to be possible to contact them. Some parents are being charged and relatives are being charged airfare to get their children back. So the state's responsibility is a little bit, it kicks in a little bit more when children are being placed with families, with sponsors. And at that point, you know, state guarantees for, say, representation in immigration court kick in. But I think that, you know, hopefully this will be a moot problem as kids start getting reunited with their parents more quickly. But in the meantime, I wouldn't be surprised if we did see states like New York stepping up and demanding more information about the children in their.
So what are the, I guess, the rules for who these children can be reunited with? I mean, is there a vetting process for that?
There have been some problems in the past with how that vetting has worked. The other problem here is that agency policies at the Office of Refugee Resettlement say that the first preference is to release someone to a parent. And there really hasn't been a lot of clarity from the agency as to whether if the parent is in immigration detention and they don't know how long that parent will be detained, whether they're going to keep the child in some kind of temporary shelter for however long it takes until they can be reunited with the parent, or whether they'll be willing to find an uncle or a cousin or somebody who might be theoretically down the chain and release them more quickly.
So here's another problem with that. So there are relatives who these children can be released to, but many of them themselves are undocumented. And lately, this is a recent development, a requirement has been instituted by the Trump administration that these people who want custody, these relatives or whoever wants to take charge of the child, has to provide fingerprints and has to disclose their immigration status. And this is, of course, very frightening and is discouraging people probably from applying or, you know, coming forward and saying that they will take custody.
I mean, on the one hand, that sounds like a logical step to take to protect the safety of these children, right? We don't, there's a lot of concern that these children could be trafficked if they're not protected, or in other cases, maybe taken in by folks who are, who they shouldn't be taken in by. What's your, both of your sense of how quickly and how realistic it'll be for these children to be reunited with their parents?
Well, first I want to say that, you know, the idea that children are going to be trafficked, particularly for tiny children, is really ludicrous. You know, it's a piece of rhetoric that comes out of the anti-trafficking movement that was taken up by people in the Trump administration. So, you know, people have to fill out now this, parents even have to fill out an 8-page form. Parents have had their children taken from them, have to fill out an 8-page form and go through this vetting process where they sort of have to prove that it's safe for the child to be with them when the child was removed from them under the presumption that it wasn't safe simply because they came up through in dangerous circumstances. And of course, they had no control over those dangerous circumstances. And people that I've spoken with have said, I had to do it because it was safer than staying in my country and having both of us killed or my son killed or having me killed. So, you know, it's very, I think it's a very cruel situation, but I just wanted to point out that this little piece of rhetoric about trafficking is pretty ludicrous.
Yeah, I agree that it's a very remote concern that, you know, because of the way this story first came to public attention, I think has kind of assumed an oversized importance. But I also do think that it's going to be a very real political problem for HHS to try to deal with as it tries to find placement. I think the bottom line here is the government told the federal courts that they could do this, you know, whenever they wanted to. We're going to see whether that was a realistic promise or not. But the other question for me is, under what circumstances are families going to be reunited? Are we going to see families getting reunited by being placed in immigration detention for unknown amounts of time as they continue to fight the Flores settlement in court? Or are we going to see them, you know, allowing families to get released with ankle bracelets or case management systems that, you know, constitute quote unquote catch and release that the Trump administration, I'm sorry, has been complaining about to begin with.
And we've also been focused very much on the more than 2,000 children that have been separated from their families. But I'm wondering what's happening to folks who are continuing to try and come into the United States.
So actually, so-called catch and release has been going on during the entire time that the government was saying that there was zero tolerance. I mean, people have been coming in since May 7th when the separation of children and families, you know, was put into play, into official play. And people are still being released with their kids and given ankle bracelets. So that's another piece of chaos. You know, it has been the case that there simply hasn't been infrastructure to, you know, separate and detain all of these people. So, yes, people are coming in now and they're getting the ankle bracelets and they're still with their kids. But I know that because there's a shelter here in the Rio Grande Valley in South Texas, which is packed now with such people. But, you know, there were people coming in before who were going into the shelters. I was surprised. I was in El Paso and saw two adults and three kids walking down the street, and one had a bracelet on her ankle. And I asked them what was up. And they said, well, we were caught yesterday crossing, and we were let go and put into a shelter. So it's not true that this has even worked so smoothly, you know, this separation since it started.
That said, they are taking this opportunity after the executive order was signed to kind of increase that capacity. The request that was sent to the Department of Defense last week said that they ultimately want to be able to put 12,000 families in detention, which is a many-fold increase from what long-term family detention looks like right now. So it's entirely possible that more families will end up detained for, you know, as long as months or even years together under the, you know, post-family separation policy than were actually separated under the peak of family separation.
And I have to say that people will keep coming. I mean, they will keep coming because, again, what they tell me is that even though this is pretty horrendous for them, it's not anywhere near as much as the risk of staying where they are.
Debbie Nathan is a freelance reporter covering the border for The Intercept, and Dara Lind is a senior reporter with Vox covering immigration. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A whole lot of you have called in to share your thoughts on our coverage of family separation and immigration.
We made the terrible situation that has continued to this day and is creating refugees that we now want to stop at the border. We're responsible for creating the refugees. If we don't let them into this country, we should pay the cost of them going to a country that will accept them.
What we've heard off and on, and nobody is talking about it, are these facilities just going up, some of them already up, and a lot of them privately put up. So could we also talk about the profit motive here and who's making the money off of them and so forth?
If there are specific topics on the immigration debate you'd like us to cover or just generally want to share your thoughts, give us a call at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE.
Muchas gracias de todo corazón. ¡Que viva México! ¡Viva México! ¡Viva México!
In a resounding victory, leftist candidate and former mayor of Mexico City, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, won Sunday's presidential elections in Mexico. For years, López Obrador had been calling for an end to the corruption that permeates Mexican politics and has been a champion for the poor and Mexico's indigenous communities. This was his third bid for the Mexican presidency.
Estoy convencido.
I am convinced that the most efficient and humane way to confront violence and insecurity necessitates the fight against inequality and poverty. Peace and tranquility are the fruits of justice.
But López Obrador will take the helm as the country experiences unparalleled levels of violence. During this election cycle alone, 138 politicians and candidates were murdered. Here to talk to us today about the elections is Andalusia Knoll, a freelance journalist based in Mexico City.
This is a historic moment. It's the first time in over 80 years that there is a leftist president in Mexico that doesn't represent the PRI party or the PAN party. This is the third time that he has run for the presidency. Many of his supporters do believe that he actually won the presidency in 2006 and that it was fraud, that Felipe Calderón in power, and then he ran once again in 2012, as Mexican elections are only every 6 years, and then in 2018. And his win this time is historic. He has over a 30% lead over Ricardo Anaya of the PAN party. And it is also not just the presidency, but it is looking like this new leftist and center leftist party has taken control in Mexico. It is a historic moment.
And let's talk a little bit about why now. I mean, you just mentioned that López Obrador had run. This is the third time he's run. So what was it about this moment that led to his not just win, but the majority win, as you mentioned?
Yes, Mexico is living a very, very severe crisis. Homicide rate is the highest that it's ever been. Over 100,000 people were murdered just last year. There's a security crisis. There's an economic crisis. And people are just fed up. And repeatedly, when I spoke to voters about who they were voting for and why they were voting for López Obrador, they mentioned two words over and over: change and hope. And then also many of them just talked about the PRI party, which is the ruling party now, and said that they really just can't take more. The Peña Nieto administration has been marked by two scandals, one being the disappearance of 43 students in the state of Guerrero from the school of Ayotzinapa, that to the date, it is unknown what happened to these students once they were kidnapped by Mexican police. And there's also the White House scandal, where the president was linked to a multi-million dollar home that is in the possession of his wife and his family. So both these two scandals, I think, have pushed people over the top of no longer believing in the PRI, which has ruled in Mexico for so long, and believing in the possibility of change. And they see that López Obrador represents that change.
And let's also talk a little bit about this win. There are lots of folks who are saying, commentators who've been saying, that López Obrador is the answer to Donald Trump, or is Mexico's response to Donald Trump. I think I'd love for you to sort of break that down for us, because on the one hand, is that essentially what the movement was in Mexico in sort of looking at this and selecting this leader? On the other hand, how much of a referendum is it really on Donald Trump?
Yesterday, when I went to the voting polls and I asked people, I will tell you that not one single person mentioned Trump. This election is not about Donald Trump. It is about what I just mentioned, the corruption and the violence in Mexico. Every candidate is against Donald Trump in Mexico. But I think just what, for me, I mean, I've been living in Mexico now for 7 years, so for me, it is a hopeful moment, specifically regarding security strategy, because in Mexico, for the past 12 years, we've had the quote-unquote war on drugs, which has not just been a war on drugs. It's been a war on the general population.
But that's what I want to ask you about, yeah, Andalusia, right, because I feel like there's one thing for, you know, for us to talk about López Obrador's future, but also he's walking into a situation, as you mentioned earlier in the segment, where the violence in the country is at a very high rate. And it's not just drug cartels. It's also violence against political candidates, violence against journalists. How did López Obrador remain unscathed himself? And what are his plans to curb this violence against not just Mexican citizens, but political candidates and also journalists?
Right. I mean, yesterday I saw many people that did not feel represented by one of the candidates. They are paper ballots and they were writing in messages. So I saw that one journalist actually wrote that he is not voting for any presidential candidate because they have all remained silent on the issue of assassinations of journalists. So I think that's just one issue. And as I mentioned, there's a security crisis affecting many other sectors of the population. Over 100 people that were either in office, running for office, or supporters of political parties were murdered in these elections since they started last November. So it is a very frightening situation. And yes, López Obrador cannot, even if he had the most innovative strategy coming into the mess that Mexico is right now, he obviously will not be able to just change it overnight. He has focused a lot on the corruption, and it is true that a lot of the violence in Mexico is related to corruption. So he is willing to cooperate with UN mechanisms and other international mechanisms to combat the corruption and focus on that, both in the debates, and he has not given many interviews about it. I have not seen a very clear plan to combat the corruption, but he has said that he will focus on it and has also talked about having an amnesty for people that are at the bottom of the drug trafficking production line. And that means the farmers who grow poppies, which are then exported for opiate and heroin production. But he still has yet to put forth more developed platform about security and also what he will do regarding corruption. But one thing is that he has said that he will not pursue the military strategy of those who came before him, which is Felipe Calderón and Peña Nieto, who have tried to combat Mexico's security issues by putting more soldiers on the street, which has been documented has not led to increased security, instead has led to increased human rights violations, more murders, disappearances, and has done anything but make the Mexican population safer.
Ana Luz Yanol is a freelance journalist based in Mexico City. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Last December, WNYC reporter Alana Casanova Burgess was in Ciales, Puerto Rico, going through a box of food aid that had been delivered to the island.
¿Qué tenemos aquí? Toast and pop-ups, chocolate fudge,
no me.
Green beans, 4 cans, 2 flour tortilla bags, 2 boxes of saltine crackers, 4 cans of loaded potato with bacon progresso rich and hearty soup.
Some of the food was what you'd expect in a disaster relief package, like tortillas and green beans. But the off-brand Pop-Tarts with 17 grams of sugar or the potato soup with more than 30% of your daily recommended sodium intake, those might get you through some tough times, but they probably aren't good for you in the long term. And people took notice. A photo showing a pile of FEMA rations went viral. The food? Cheez-Its, cans of tuna, Baby Ruth candy bars, and Airheads.
There's no one company or three companies that can handle this kind of volume when you get 3 storms coming at you from 6 different directions.
Barry Sendell is the founder and president of Chef Minute Meals, which supplied shelf-stable food to FEMA after Hurricane Maria. He says the need for food aid last fall was way bigger than people in the industry were used to, and that caused people to scramble.
So there were companies, people were just throwing a whole lot of stuff into a box, and they were not being, what I would say, up and up with what they were shipping to FEMA.
Some people were outraged and other people were thankful to have something to eat. So there was some debate about that, but I was particularly concerned given the research that we have there and, you know, the high prevalence of obesity and diabetes and hypertension in this population.
Dr. Uri Joan Colon Ramos is a professor of public health at George Washington University. She went down to Puerto Rico 6 weeks after the hurricane hit, and she says her research found that the food aid given to people after Maria was too salty and too sugary.
So we went there for 10 days to the federal distribution center there, and we saw the foods as they arrived. We were able to open different packages. One of the first things that we would do is take pictures of a package unopened, and then take the pictures of the packages as we were opening them, and then take pictures of the contents of those boxes and the nutritional facts labels of those to be able to document what are the added sugars, if they were listed, sometimes they were not, saturated fat and sodium, total kilocalories, ingredients, etc. And we did that for 10 days, and we found that the majority of the foods that were provided were snacks and sweets, and within the snacks and sweets, 20% were actually those candies and chips. And there were also vegetables, there were dairy, there were fruits, and there were mixed dishes. Mixed dishes are basically pasta dishes like beefaroni, but the majority of those foods were basically snack and sweets followed by those mixed dishes and then fruits.
So someone could say, well, that's not so bad. I mean, these are folks who were in desperate need of food. They have food.
Absolutely. So they had this food, and we also then used these foods to try to make, you know, a meal plan following the federal nutritional guidelines. And what we found is that we could meet, just uniquely from the foods received, could meet the amount of grains and the amount of protein that they need to be eating for example, but they couldn't do so without exceeding the added sugars, sodium, or saturated fat upper limits for a day. So in a way, it just doesn't align. The types of foods just don't align. And I have to say, we did this excluding the very low nutritional value foods. So choosing among the most healthful food options that were provided there. I think we can do a little bit better than that.
Tell us about what average food rations for disaster relief look like. Are they generally full of junk food, or do they tend to be more nutritious, just across the board?
So emergency foods in the international arena have very strict nutritional guidelines that they have to follow, and it's based on micronutrients and caloric need of the population that is being affected. In the United States, I think in terms of what has been provided, we know a little bit less. But, you know, since 1999, we know that emergency foods, as part of any kind of program that delivers foods and that comes through, you know, federal agencies, needs to abide and follow the dietary guidelines for American, which are those federal nutritional guidelines. But the logistics might make it very challenging to do that. But we do know that that's at least the guidance that should be there and that they should be following.
And I'm also curious about, I know, you know, there's often people talk about government cheese, for example, but I know that that is a real thing. I mean, the federal government has, for its low-income residents, does have food available, at least in cheese and butter and peanut butter and oatmeal and things like that. Why such a disconnect between what we see in disaster relief versus what we see for often low-income Americans?
I'm not really sure why that is. I certainly have my thoughts about, number one, it could be some logistical challenges in monitoring, but I think that's often quoted as, you know, it's emergency food. This is not a new problem, by the way. I mean, this happens also in food banks. It raises that question, is any food better than nutritionally sound food? And it's a question that can be scientifically answered. If you think that providing comfort through these foods is important, then we need to define what comfort is, what comfort means to the populations that are receiving it, not the populations that are providing it. But it's important to take that into consideration. I think as a researcher in nutrition, the main concern is that these are foods that the government is providing. The government is also saying that we should be following these nutritional guidelines. And on the other hand, there's also the question of like, well, how much does this really contribute to the diet? That was another thing, because the foods may have arrived later, or some people may not have seen it at all. But I think it does send a message when you receive, you know, a box full of M&Ms and potato chips. What is it? And who made this decision? And what does this mean for guidelines? Why is the government providing this and providing some other guidelines that seems almost incongruous?
Are you hopeful that there will be changes, adequate changes made to emergency meals themselves and or the distribution of those meals in the future?
I am hopeful. I know that there is a lot of talk about this in the international arena. They're looking very closely at the issues of nutrition in humanitarian responses internationally. And I think we can learn a lot about what is happening internationally to apply it to the United States. I think historically and traditionally, not just, you know, internationally, but also domestically, we have focused on providing enough water and enough calories and making sure that people don't go hungry, which makes perfect sense, and that is imperative. But now we're seeing that these disasters might continue, you know, on a more frequent basis, maybe more chronically, and the people who will be most affected are the same vulnerable populations that have high risk of diabetes and hypertension and diet-related chronic diseases. And I don't think we're doing a good job at taking that into consideration in the emergency guidelines, not in a practical way. And you see it then when these disasters are happening and you see what people are being provided.
Dr. Uri Joan Colon Ramos is a professor of public health at George Washington University. Doctor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We reached out to FEMA for comment. In an email, a spokesperson told us that the meals the agency and its contractors provide, quote, meet the basic requirements recommended by USDA. They added that FEMA has used candy or crackers within its meals as substitute items, but said, quote, these items are used in urgent circumstances when the primary menu component is not immediately available for survivor distribution. The United States Citizenship and Immigration Services is creating a new task force. Its goal is to examine what they say are bad naturalization cases, according to Director Francis Cisna. As a result, the agency expects to hire dozens of lawyers and immigration officers in the coming weeks to find U.S. citizens they say should not have been naturalized, revoke their citizenship, and then eventually deport them. Or Jadu is with me to explain. She's a former chief counsel for the USCIS and is now the director of the immigrant advocacy group DHS Watch. She's also an immigration law professor at Washington College of Law at American University. Thanks for being here, Or.
Thank you for inviting me.
So let's start at the beginning. What is denaturalization and how often does it happen?
So it's a very rare thing that happens. Denaturalization is the process that is used to take away the naturalization that someone obtained after immigrating to the United States in cases where perhaps the naturalization was obtained through other identities or through some kind of fraud, misrepresentation.
And for some of our listeners who may not be aware, can you just explain quickly what being naturalized means?
Sure. So usually when a person immigrates to the United States, comes from another country, they begin a process. And let's just talk about, for example, a very typical example of a student. Comes here for college, spends several years on a student visa. Let's say they decide they would like to find a job in the United States after they graduate from college. They then go on to a work visa, some of the more famous visas, H-1Bs, for example. And then their employer says, well, we really like you. We would like to keep you forever, or we'd like you to stay. So we're going to try to get you what is lawful permanent residence, and many people know it as a green card. And that takes a long time to get. Then the person is a lawful permanent resident, and after generally 5 years, good moral character, and various other requirements a person has to go through, they may apply for naturalization and then become what is a full U.S. citizen, just like someone who is born in the United States, and they have all the rights to vote and participate fully in our society.
Now, you just described a very involved process. There's been a big focus on what the administration has called criminal aliens, and I'm quoting their own language there. And so I think most Americans would say, well, you know, if someone has committed a crime or isn't somebody that we want to have in the United States, they would sort of maybe understand the involved process that this organization is looking to undertake. My question to you is, are these folks, these estimated 2,500 people, are these people who are working in the United States, have been here for a couple of decades, have paid Social Security, and now we're looking at their paperwork?
Yeah, so this is a problem that goes back. So every time a person tries to obtain a benefit, an immigration benefit, they have to provide their fingerprints. And this has been something the United States has been doing for many years, decades. Well, those fingerprints were collected on paper before we had the technology to collect them electronically. And then there came a time where they were collected on paper and then put into a database, an electronic database, when electronic databases were created, which is in the 90s. And now they're collecting them mostly digitally. So now they're going straight into these databases that are all used to check. Every time a person tries to obtain a benefit, a person's fingerprints are checked against these databases to connect them to whomever they were throughout the process. Well, as you can imagine, some people may have came to the U.S. before all of these fingerprints were collected digitally, before all of these fingerprints that were collected on paper were digitized, which is an extreme effort to go back to every file and input those fingerprints in. And not all of those paper file fingerprint cards from a long time ago were completely added to these electronic databases that are searched.
So let me just be clear. There are about 2,500 folks whose cases are going to be reviewed. Is that correct?
That's what I understand.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so, and this is just because of a suspicion of having used incorrect or improper paperwork, or what's triggering this group in particular?
Well, according to the Inspector General, there was a group of people that At the time that they were naturalized, their fingerprint cards that were collected before were not inputted into the databases that USCIS had searched at that time that they were seeking naturalization.
Are American citizens who've been naturalized outside of this 2,500 or estimated 2,500, should they be concerned? Do they have to worry about potentially having their cases brought up in the future?
So this is the part that concerns me the most. I worked in the government. Every American should be very concerned that their government should always ensure, essentially, they should practice principles of good governance. If there is a problem and people are being naturalized when they shouldn't be, well, we should identify what that problem is. We should correct it, and we should prevent such instances of problems occurring in the future. And that's what the Inspector General noted in their 2016 report, that this problem was identified in 2008, 2009, and since then, efforts were being made to fix the problem. And in fact, in 2016, when the IG report came out, the DHS spokesperson was saying, well, we're redoubling our efforts, we're going to do even more to ensure that we correct the problem. And that is the right thing for any good government to do. And my concern is, why all the public notice? What is the issue? Why are you publicly doing this now? Based on the track record of this administration that believes in many ways and has used fear to send a message to immigrant populations, it suggests something other than good government. It suggests perhaps that they're wanting to use fear again for people who are potentially seeking naturalization or those who have already naturalized, that they should be worried that perhaps their naturalization could be reviewed and potentially questioned.
Oor Jadu is the director of the immigrant advocacy group DHS Watch. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Gerald Fishman, Rob Hyacin, John McNamara, Rebecca Smith, Wendy Winters. I wanted to take this moment to acknowledge the five people who were killed last Thursday in the newsroom at the Capital Gazette in Annapolis, Maryland. Funerals and memorial services for several of the victims will be held throughout the week. It was the deadliest day for American journalists since 9/11. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, so far in 2018, at least 33 journalists have been killed in the line of duty worldwide. We have all of them in our thoughts this week. Thanks so much for being with me today. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.